You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, July 13th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Tara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, New York City.
So this is the show that's going to air on July 20th, which is a date that will be, you'll see why that's important in just a moment. Nexus evolved out of the Perry DeAngelis Memorial sort of SGU event. And so we do like to always begin our Nexus live show remembering those fellow skeptics. I mean, obviously there's more than we can account for at any one time. But these are the people who are particularly close to the SGU, who we have lost along the way on our journey, obviously including Perry. But also, unfortunately, the list is growing. That's just life. And we'll keep remembering those skeptics that we left behind. All right. This is a picture of, anyone know what this is? Manhattan Henge.
You're so good.
This is a picture from last year because we had cloud cover this year. And I couldn't get a good picture.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But this it looks the same. If I didn't tell you that this was this last year, you would not know the difference.
Except for the clothing styles.
Yeah.
No, they're the same. They didn't change
much. Yeah, fashion's changed so fast. We're on the fashion district.
True.
Yeah.
Just
gotta keep up.
You're talking about fashion?
Yes, I'm talking about fashion. Are you implying something?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think it peaked last night, from what I understand. Yeah, but it's still sort of happening tonight, from what I understand. All right. So what we're seeing for the audience at home, we're looking at a picture of what looks like a camera, right? That could be like any modern security camera. But does anybody know exactly what that is?
Westinghouse Lunar Television Camera Model 2.
Besides you.
That is an oddly specific answer.
Is that you, Mom?
So, like, yes, Model 3.
That is the camera that was on the LEM, on the Lunar Landing Module for Apollo 11. Apollo 11, of course, you know, that mission took place on July 20th. Right? July 20th was when the day they landed, or the day they launched? I forget. They landed, yeah. So they landed on the moon July 20th, 1969. So this is the day this show airs is the 50th anniversary of, you know, one of the, if not the most momentous occasions in human history. I don't think it's, you know, hyperbole to say that. That's the first moment that our species walked on another world. It was an absolutely amazing accomplishment. It was, you know, the culmination of years of just incredible work. The probability of failure so many places along the way was extremely high. The fact that they pulled it off and nobody died is really amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, on that mission, nobody died. People died along the way. And the reason why we're showing that camera is because, of course, that was the camera that filmed Neil Armstrong walking out of the LEM and onto the lunar surface.
And in 50 years, they'll show you a picture of the camera that took the picture of that camera. I think that picture is cool. And a little scary for a couple of reasons. One, yeah, it's a camera that captured one of the most important visuals of mankind. And it's also kind of rickety looking, you know what I mean? Like
kind of janky.
Yeah, it has like a kid's constructor set look to it. And like, what's that wire hanging off? Like, you know, I don't know if it's charging a battery or whatever, but like, okay, that was on the moon.
It looks pretty sturdy though, Jay.
What?
Looks pretty sturdy to me. Lots of bolts everywhere.
It doesn't have a sci-fi look to it. It has a utilitarian look to it. Like, it just
has to
function.
That's right.
Yeah, it looks like, remember, we saw that when we were at the Air and Space Museum recently, we saw the lunar lander, and it does look like a very sturdy Tinker Toy. You know, but it doesn't have the clean lines.
No, it looked kind of mishmashed, like with weird shapes covering some instruments, and also, I've said this before, but I remember one of the astronauts saying that, like, They had to be really careful with their tools because there was places in there where if they dropped it, the tool would fall through the ship. You know, like it would cut, yeah. it would cut through like the cellophane, reflecting cellophane stuff that would cut through. Like, what?
Yeah, everything just kind of looked like it was made with foil and duct tape.
Well, there was foil on everything.
It looked janky, but that's because it was the only one.
Yeah,
like,
I
these
agree.
Things aren't mass-produced.
It was
right?
almost like it was a prototype in a way. Yeah, it wasn't mass-produced, and it was completely utilitarian. You know, it was built by engineers, not as a commercial product or something that was going to be mass-produced. Just to function. So to our modern eyes, it makes it look it has this Erector Set kind of feel to it.
But they didn't 3D print that thing.
No 3D printing. Why is that camera so important? So. 50 years after one of the greatest achievements of our species, there are still people who deny that it happened, which is amazing, but which says a lot about
people,
our brains, our psychology. One of the things I want to do, we're going to do a couple of news of space, you know, Apollo-related news items today, since it's the 50th anniversary. But I'm going to start with just, there was a recent article that took an angle to debunk the moon hoax conspiracy theory that I hadn't read previously. I've read a lot of things similar to this, around this, but what they did was analyze the plausibility of whether or not you could have duplicated the apparent effect of low gravity by slowing down the film. Right? So that's one of the claims of conspiracy theorists, is that they're not really jumping around on the moon with low gravity. You could just slow down the film and make it look like you're in low gravity.
But you wouldn't be able to jump as high in normal gravity, right? Your arc wouldn't be this. That's
yeah, so there's a lot of ways to debunk that, and it's been thoroughly debunked by physics, right? So
you could, and the best way is the rover, the way the rover would kick up, the regolith, and the arc it would take, and the time it would, that you cannot duplicate in slow motion or anything on Earth gravity.
And the Mythbusters did a great job of, they actually, you got into spacesuits and jumped around, and then slowed it down. And it looks nothing like what you were seeing with the Apollo footage. But this took a purely film approach.
Yeah.
So what they said was, okay, here are the actual cameras that existed at the time. Right? You either have film, which runs at a certain frame rate, or you had video. And your choices for video was, like, I think it's either 20 or 30 frames per second. If you shoot at that frame rate and slow it down, of course you have half as many frames per second, which of course you could notice. What you know, normally how you film things in slow motion is that you film at a higher frame rate, which is called overcranking, which is an archaic term because you were literally cranking film, and then they figured, oh, we could crank faster, and then when you play it back, they'll be in slow motion.
For example, I have an interesting example. When they blew up the Death Star in the original Star Wars movie, they filmed that, I think, somewhere around, was it like 1,000 frames per second or something, and then when they played it at 24, it seemed like this gargantuan explosion that was taking a little time because it was so big.
Because it was so big, right. That's a common technique.
Another example of that, like when we watched the movie recently where they colorized World War One footage.
They showed World War II.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
It was World War I.
They didn't just colorize it. They also completely compensated as best as they could for movement rate. You know, they corrected the speed of the people. So as best as they could, they made it look like modern footage of World War I. It was really remarkable. Yeah, and that was Peter Jackson did that.
Yeah, typical World War I footage, if you've seen it before. It has, everybody looks like they're moving at double speed something to that.
Because it was manually being cranked, and you couldn't get it exactly right.
I mean, that's what makes it look cartoony, but it was cool. And Peter Jackson said this in an interview afterwards, was that when they slowed it down, and it was like your eye can detect minuscule frame rate change that isn't natural speed. As soon as they got it into a normal speed, all of a sudden they turned into people and not cartoony.
Oh, wow.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It reminds me of what they did with the Bigfoot footage, right?
Yes.
The famous Patterson-Gimli film, you know, when they actually took the frames and put them all, you know,
they stabilized
up and down of frames. You stabilize it. It's just some guy walking across
It looks like a guy walking across the lawn.
Exactly.
And Evan, did you know that Bigfoot has an exceptionally large middle finger?
Oh.
I heard that somewhere.
Thank you.
All right.
There's people in the front. Thank you.
So if you actually try to do the technique of filming at a higher frame rate and then slowing it down. So remember, this was being streamed. Even whether you think it was in a studio or on the moon, This was being broadcast, was the term at the time, right? It would actually be better than stream. This is being broadcast.
I think they know what a broadcast is.
Don't cross the channels there, because there is a difference between
I know. That's why I corrected it. It was being broadcast. But the point is, the analysis basically was, in order to broadcast it in slow motion, you have to film it at a high frame rate in regular motion, buffer it, and slow it down, mm-hmm. which means you need to store that information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You couldn't really do it in film mm-hmm. unless you were doing it you know, a long time beforehand and then playing it back. So either way, though, that would have required a tremendous amount of memory, which didn't even exist at the time. Or you would have required, like they calculated for the continuous Apollo 11 landing footage, you would have needed something like 6 reels of film, something ridiculous, mm-hmm. which was clearly not present there. So even if you think it's in the studio. And then again, it couldn't have been film because there's artifacts in film which are kind of unavoidable, which we can fix today. But you got to any hypothesis you have, they had to have been able to mimic with 1969 technology.
Yeah, but then they can easily argue like, well, NASA had secret technology.
Yeah, which is BS, yeah, right? I know, that's what they do say. They just say, yeah, well, NASA had super advanced technology. Come on.
And from our side of the fence, it's like, was state of the art.
Yeah.
The stuff,
that was it.
The technology
right.
that they created for this space program, you know, we've right. talked about these lists before, inspired things that we use in our lives even today.
Yeah.
That's how cutting edge and
databases, for example.
I cannot wait till we get back to the moon, take real photographs of the things, the debris that we left on the moon from the Apollo missions.
Yeah, but they'll just say it was fake.
All those damn conspiracy theorists.
I have a question that there isn't an answer to yet, but I love the idea of preserving that first footprint. I don't know. Did Neil Armstrong like have that footprint and then it got destroyed with them getting on and off the spacecraft?
No. I think it's still there, but it will be eroded away by micrometeorites in about 1 million years.
What I'm saying is, I want that needs to be in a human museum. Like that has to be.
You got to put glass around
it. Encase
it.
Yeah.
But also the other thing is, you have to remember Apollo 11 wasn't the only lunar mission, right? So you also have to then account for all the later Apollo missions, which had even higher quality video and longer. And again, we didn't have the technology to duplicate that in slow motion at the time.
What's the standard reasoning? I mean, I know it's just conspiratorial thinking. Yeah. We want to think it was fake, but why is the idea that it was fake so appealing?
I have an answer.
Okay.
I think this all comes from men who cheat on their spouses. They want to prove that the picture of them with the woman is fake. And they said, NASA did it. It's not me.
But we can do that now. We can fake plenty of video. We can actually make people seem like they're... But what is it about we never actually landed on the moon, we had to fake it, that is so... Yeah. appealing to people.
Part of it, I think, is distrust of authority, which is clearly in there. Even flat Earth people, I think, they don't trust the government, they don't trust other governments, they don't trust pilots, they don't trust scientists. That's massive. That's distrust on a massive scale.
So that's like the standard kind of conspiracy crank view of
You can prove any conspiracy like that, any grand conspiracy, then you could basically use that to say, therefore, we can't trust the government about anything.
Right.
And therefore, anything I want to believe, I can justify. And any evidence you bring to bear is like, well, we know we can't trust any authority because they lied about going to the moon.
But are there Mars rover deniers?
Probably.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
All right.
They're just not as
vocal. Who is that? Everybody, this is an iconic picture of an astronaut standing on the lunar surface next to an American flag. Anyone know who that is?
Buzz?
It's Buzz Aldrin.
But there's your proof, Steve.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no air on the moon. How could that flag be in that position without wind?
Right. All right, so Jay.
Wow.
Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong died recently, but Buzz Aldrin is still alive. And he wrote an article recently giving his opinion about where NASA should be going from here.
Yeah, so Buzz has been active in the space community, and now he has recently been advocating for this idea that, you know, we're going to have a gateway orbiting platform above the moon. He wants there to be a gateway orbiting platform in low Earth orbit. And his reasoning, he has a lot of reasoning about it. One, of course, and the most obvious is that it's right there. And, you know, it doesn't really help us that much with deep space exploration to have it be orbiting the moon. It's, you know, it's easier to transport things into low Earth orbit than it is to do that second jump to the moon. It's faster. And on top of that, ultimately, it costs less money.
Unless you do some of the mining on the moon and from there bring it to low moon orbit and then from there to the deeper solar system.
He's not saying exclusively. He's saying we should start with the Earth. And, you know, I mean, I can't like, counteract his idea. Like, I can't give you really good reasons why we shouldn't do that. I mean, I think, you know, having a firm plan and executing on the plan safely and that's economically feasible should be number one. I do love the idea of revisiting the moon, but I have this science fiction fantasy of it being, you know, moon base alpha, and, I just want that to happen. But, I mean, I do think that this is not a bad idea. It's an idea that needs to be run through the NASA machine to see if it makes sense. But there's lots of things attached to this that are important. One of them is definitely the idea of privatizing space exploration, and that they want to do this project in conjunction with other companies. Like, there's companies now that are already developing space laboratories, and he has three sections or modules that he wants this first iteration to have. And one of them is just a raw space laboratory that NASA would parse out to whoever wants to rent space on it and do testing on it. Then there would be, like, the space hotel, which would generate money. That could be used in lots of different ways, but one of them would be space tourism. And then the third one would be, you know, a living module and things to manage people. But it's a great idea. It's also an idea that doesn't, if they said tomorrow, let's do this, it wouldn't change that much of what's already been done. You know, of course, what's the difference between the gravity or the microgravity that exists orbiting the moon versus there's details, of course, that are important that you have to probably prepare a lot more for people to be all the way out to the moon and stay there for a month. Versus people just being in orbit. They could just use a simple spaceship to get back in an emergency. And I just don't know what to think about this. You have thoughts on it.
Well, I mean, it's a solid idea. In fact, Isaac Asimov said this 40 years ago, 50 years ago. He basically made the exact same physics point that getting into Earth orbit is where most of your energy is.
Halfway there. When you get into Earth orbit, you're halfway to wherever you're going.
Yeah, I mean, that's a metaphor, but obviously it's not literally true.
No, it's
but,
true.
But you know what I mean? That, certainly going to the moon, most of your energy is used getting out of Earth's gravity well.
Yeah.
And so the same is, depends on how far you're going, obviously, but you don't want to land on a heavy planet, right? If you want to limit the amount of stuff you're bringing up and down from the surface of the Earth. Yeah. So having a platform that's in orbit. So you just get the pilots to that, and then the big ships never land, right? I mean, NASA figured that out going to the moon. Their initial plan was to land a rocket, Buck Rogers style, on the moon and then blast off the whole rocket again. There was one particular scientist like, that's never going to happen. You're never going to do that.
How much fuel you'd need for that?
You don't have enough fuel.
My gosh.
You have to send the smallest piece down. So they ended up sending piece of the ship and then only blasting a piece of that back up, like the smallest amount, to blast
back
off. But
it came
with,
that was a really complicated thing.
Yeah, so the point is,
off.
I know, but now if you put an infrastructure in place, so imagine you have a platform in Earth orbit, you have a platform in lunar orbit, so you just use landers to get people and whatever you specifically need up and down from the gravity well, the minimal stuff, supplies, people. Mm-hmm. And the ships that you go back and forth between Earth and the moon never land, right? They're just shuttles. And the same thing with Mars. You're just shuttling around outside of any massive gravity well, and then you use the smallest piece possible to get up and down from the planet. And that's what you do. Of course, we have this science fiction notion in our head of ships blasting off from the surface of a planet and then traveling somewhere, but that's not anywhere in our near future.
And that's why I like the idea that have been proposed of sending, like, say, robots to Mars and have them kind of mine and accumulate fuel on Mars. So you land on Mars and using your last bit of fuel almost, and then you have fuel there waiting, and then just blast off from from there. That would save a ton of money.
But Bob, why don't they just lower something on a rope from orbit?
Space elevator.
Like, explain this to me.
Yeah, the space elevator thing.
You want to get into the space elevator?
No, I didn't say space elevator. I'm
but
talking about the space winch. You lower something down to the planet.
But from where? From low Earth orbit? Then it's being dragged along with you as you're flying around the Earth.
But you always worry about the physics. I'm just saying, why don't we do it?
That's why. All right.
That's this week's quote. Steve, you always worry about the physics. Jay Novella.
The last comment I want to make about this is, you know, I've been reading a lot about not just Apollo, but also currently what is NASA doing, and it's really disheartening that there's no vision right now. So NASA has some ideas about what they'd like to do, but it doesn't really mean anything until Congress gives them the money for
right.
it. And then the White House has ideas about what they want NASA to do, but they can't give them the money. And it's completely different than the way it was in the 1960s when it was a bipartisan, everyone was on the same page, this is what we're doing, here's a whole boatload of money, do this.
Yeah.
Right now, NASA doesn't know what it's supposed to do. It's building a rocket system to go to the moon, to go to Mars, whatever.
Yeah,
it's
just a
rocket
system. We had a Cold War that sort of, you know, helped propel us.
Yeah, but
to
Steve,
the moon.
I would disagree a little bit because I think it was a huge milestone, and I was very happy when they made the decision, or seemed to have made the decision, that the moon is a great way to start, and then from there you can
but
go to Mars.
But who made that decision?
Well,
that's the problem. That's what I'm saying. Since then, I've learned that means nothing because there's no unified vision about exactly what we're going to do. As Jay said, we need a plan. There's no plan right now. There's just different ideas about maybe what we should do, but
Space Force.
Not everyone's Space Force. Not everyone's on the same page. Until Congress and NASA and the executive branch get on the same page, it doesn't mean anything. We don't know what we're doing right now.
Agreed, but at the very least, now there's not a lot of people that are saying, "Let's go right to Mars right now as soon as we can first."
Yeah.
I think our country and a lot of other countries agree that you got to go to the moon first.
That's a very small piece of it. Until you know
that's huge, though, because remember the plan to a one-way trip to Mars that a few years ago? That was ridiculous.
It's certainly better than not knowing
cancer.
If you're even going to Moon or the Mars, but we're not anywhere near where we need to be.
Agreed.
To have a coherent plan to get us into whatever the next thing is going to be.
But it's also kind of weird because I'm like reading tons of news articles about, you know, because of the decision to go to the Moon. Like, they are developing stuff. Like, stuff's in the works.
But it has been in the works. They just don't know what they're going to use it for.
But that's the freaky part. Like, what do you mean it's in the works? Like, how can you can't partially execute a partial vision, you know?
I know, that's my point.
But NASA does that all the time. Yeah. Like, there are so many projects at NASA right now. If you go to JPL, there are Europa Labs and there are Enceladus Labs. And people do have grand visions of eventually getting there. But these things take decades to complete. So it's not like you start today and you're going to go there in a year. Like, all of these projects are actively happening right now. It's just whether or not the funding starts to shunt over.
It's hard to stay on task long enough through multiple funding cycles.
Kara, are you saying no? Because this would cool my engines a little bit. Like, they're constantly developing technology and doing stuff, and then, like, you know, this moon thing happens, right? The government says, let's do it. NASA's like, oh, hell yeah, let's do it. Now they're like, okay, so we could use that. We could use that laboratory this guy's working on. We could use this thing that she's working on and kind of, you know, mishmash it into a mission.
Well, they don't mishmash it. I mean, it's actually really well organized. But yeah, like, there are scientists who have science programs that are always going on. And then what happens when a mission gets approved is that the engineers work with the scientists to get the payload where it needs to be. So, okay, we're going to do these 10 experiments with this one ship or this one craft. We've got to figure out how to shield them and get the size down and get the weight down so that those experiments... But everything is experiment-based, at least at JPL. Because, I mean, I'm not talking about crewed missions.
Yeah, this
here.
Is
I'm
different. We're talking about, like, are we going to go back to the moon and what kind of presence are we going to have
But
there?
Again, all those we experiments need... are actively happening as well.
Okay. But I'm also talking about the fact, like, they're developing, like, the space launch system and the deep space capsule. But they're not sure what we're going to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, like, maybe we're going to go to Mars with this, or now maybe we're going to go to the moon. Are we going to have the gateway platform around the moon, or are we going to land on the moon? We don't know. They don't have a unified plan. But anyway,
what about the nuclear engines that I've been wanting for so long? I mean, there was some movement with that. That's another huge thing that I want to get into.
All right, but here's another
into.
Question, Bob. Yep. Is on longer trips, how are we going to deal with microgravity for prolonged periods of time?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Got any ideas? Oh, that's my cue? All right. So this is all about artificial or simulated gravity, and that's been in the news. Researchers are claiming that they've got a new technique that could do away with a huge problem with a specific type of artificial gravity. This is in the Journal of Vestibular Research, which should give you some clues as to what I'm going to talk about. So when we talk about artificial gravity, I kind of split it into three different things. You've got sci-fi gravity, emphasis on the phi or fiction. It's really not going to happen. And my go-to example is Star Trek? Gravity plating. That's on the ship, or at least that's what the websites are saying, that they've got duranium, some weird material. Don't get your hopes up on that. That's probably never going to happen. The bottom line is all research and lots of theories point to the fact that if you want to create gravity, you need lots of mass. You're not going to be able to flip a switch or create a material that's going to create gravity.
And you could theoretically say, well, you could use energy, but the equation, you know, of converting energy into the equivalent of mass for any effect, you know, the E equals mc squared, that's a massive amount of energy.
Yeah, c squared is a big number.
Yeah.
But people would say, graviton, what about gravitons? You know, gravitons exist. And gravitons, if you want to think about gravitons, it's a force mediator. Like, think of photons of light as a force mediator for electromagnetism. A graviton would be a force mediator for gravity. And it looks like it probably exists, especially now that we know gravitational waves exist. You can think of it as like the quantum of a gravitational wave or equivalent to a photon. And sure, that probably exists, but they're not 100% certain about it. But it's so hard to determine for sure. Like, for example, if you do some research on gravitons, some scientists are saying that, all right, so say you want to detect... You want to detect gravitons. It sounds simple, right? But they're saying you would need a Jupiter-sized detector in orbit around a neutron star for 10 years, and then maybe you would detect one graviton. So that's the kind of – that's what some of these scientists are saying.
So when's that going to happen?
Yeah.
Is NASA going to fund that next
year? Yeah, tomorrow. Yeah, next month, Steve. That's it's ridiculous. And it's even more ridiculous if you look at some of the fine details. And then to create, how about just creating gravitons? How hard could that be? But if it really is based off of gravitational waves, we're talking planetary masses here. Like, you have to rotate planetary masses to create these gravitons. So that's basically not going to happen. So that's why it's science fiction.
You have to rotate a planet to create a graviton?
Yeah, rotate in a circle to create. Basically, you need to create gravitational waves. And what are the only gravitational waves that we really can detect right now? Colliding
black
neutron
black
stars
holes.
And black holes.
Yep.
So, yeah.
What does the rotation have to do with it?
It's a rotation. It's a circular. How do they put it?
But the bottom line is, if you have the planet, you're there already. You don't really need you have
planetary
the
mass
worth of gravity.
Planetary mass rotating. What's that?
Yeah, if you have a planet, you have a planet's worth of gravity. So then it's pointless at that point.
So the point is that using gravitons, you're never going to have a switch. It's like, hey, we can create photons just to flick a switch. No, gravitons would be totally different, yeah. Right, if they exist. The next one is real artificial gravity, but it's not practical. And that's, if you've ever been in an elevator and you accelerate up to the top floor, you feel a little heavier. That linear acceleration mimics gravity. It's essentially, for all intents and purposes, it's identical to gravity with some interesting differences. And this is actually a great thing for spaceships to do. Imagine if you would accelerate at 1G, replicating Earth gravity and going to the moon. How long would it take you to get to the moon if halfway you turned around and decelerated at 1G? You can get to the moon in 3 hours, accelerating at 1G.
1G
and then
is
decelerating.
Great.
It's amazing. And how about Jupiter? You can go to Jupiter in 160 hours with that same idea.
What?
Yeah.
That's it?
That's 1 week.
The problem, though, Jay... Yeah. Accelerating for 160 hours, and then at
1G,
you're
at
going
1G, you know,
fast.
The fuel you would use, ridiculous. It's like completely impractical. So that's why it's real, but completely impractical.
I have an idea. They take the camera that they use on the moon mission, they wire it backwards, and it'll push photons out of it, and that'll be your propeller.
Yeah,
that's a good idea, Jay.
See, they got to hire me because I got all the solutions.
There's one side point, though, that always bugs me when you look at the way ships are designed, and like, here's the ship accelerating in one plane, and people are standing up in the other plane.
Right.
It's like, no, you should be standing so that your feet are facing towards the engines, because then the gravity of the acceleration would be going in the correct direction.
Darth Vader can't look out the window and say his lines.
But every sci-fi ship is designed wrong.
He'd just be looking out that window.
Yeah, but Steve,
all you have to do is go like this to the camera, and then all of a sudden everything's fine.
Yeah, you're right.
Do that, but right at the beginning of the scene.
But Steve, but then when you decelerated, the ship would need to be arranged such that when you decelerate, everything shifts around. All right, so the next one is the artificial gravity that's doable right now. And that's rotational gravity.
Yeah.
It's like in The Martian.
Right, exactly.
Right,
so my go-to example is, what is that ride at carnivals where you're in an enclosed room, it's circular, you're against the wall.
The graviton.
Okay.
So it starts spinning, and then the floor... Yeah. Leaves you, and you're stuck. You're stuck to the wall. That's artificial gravity. But there's a problem. There's a problem with that. That if you're looking straight ahead, you're fine. But if you turn your head either way, you can get nauseated, and it's really uncomfortable. I remember as a kid, I was somewhat immune to that effect, but Steve, I think Steve ever went, he would puke. He would totally puke.
But that's
puke.
Also really small. Like in The Martian, it was enormous. Like they made it a big part of the ship, so you wouldn't have that problem as much.
Correct, but the problem is you need to construct something that huge that can rotate, and that's a lot of money. So, and how does this happen? This is the appearance of a centrifugal force, which is an inertial force that recreates the gravity. So that's essentially what's happening here. But the problem is, and why are we even talking about this? Why is this important? It's because astronauts in orbit right now live this every day. Microgravity is horrible on the human body. You lose calcium, your bones start degrading, your cardiovascular fitness goes to hell. It's horrible. We did not evolve in this environment, so it's terrible. So this can address that. I mean, can you imagine doing cardio 2.5 hours every day and not even improving? You're just barely even maintaining.
How about this, Bob? So I was, for whatever reason, I was trying to answer a very simple question. How did the Apollo astronauts poop? And it's amazing how few resources address that question. Seriously, nobody wants to talk about it. But I finally found a reference which actually had a video. They had to tape a plastic bag to their bum. They had to physically seal.
I hope it wasn't duct tape because that's bad on
whatever. It was tape. They had to tape it up. It was a multi-hour process.
Oh,
you know, every
God.
Time they had to go to the bathroom, because going to the bathroom in zero G, as we learned in the movie 2001, is complicated.
Right. Well, wait, how long were these missions?
Days, week,
just
10 days.
You know, 10 days is a long time.
No, yeah, you can't.
Yeah, you can't.
If it's like
2-3
days,
I'm
sure there's just drugs.
In the modern world, it's bad enough if I forget to bring my phone with me into the John.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine having to go through. Wait, and I am sure they asked other people to help them.
Of course.
Right? So you got your fellow astronaut's butt in your face, and you're taping up his butt. That's not cool.
People are sitting in such tight quarters. Yeah.
Among the three of them, that was most of what they were doing was helping each other go to the bathroom.
Wow. Oh my God!
Right. So the picture here,
space is a filthy place,
it is.
Man.
So the picture here is a short radius centrifuge. So what their solution is to spin this, and then the centrifugal force will push your feet against the bottom, and it would be pretty much like you're standing on the Earth, and that replicate gravity enough so that to mitigate the loss of bone and cardiovascular fitness. But there's a problem. Nausea. And this is called the cross-coupled illusion. It gives you this feeling of tumbling. It's really a bizarre feeling that we experience on that gravitron thing. And that actually was a deal-breaker because you can't be sitting in something like this for hours to maintain your fitness level and then having them puking all over the place because I'd rather just do cardio and avoid that. So what the study did is try to resolve this problem. So what they did is they put people on this centrifuge. But they rotate it once a minute, and even at that low speed, you can feel nauseated. But what they did is they waited until you were acclimated to it. Nobody had really done that before, and then only once you were acclimated did they go to 2 revolutions per minute, and then 3, and then 4. They got all the way up to 17 revolutions per minute, and they were completely comfortable. They can turn their head. Nobody got nauseated, and it seemed to really it's kind of something that most anybody could become acclimated to, and it was a real breakthrough.
Wow. Yes. Can they acclimate you on Earth first before you go on your space mission?
Well, that's the question. You would absolutely need to acclimate on the Earth. Why spend days? This was like 10-day studies. You don't want to spend the first 10 days acclimating. Just do it on the Earth. But then that leads to the future problems that they need to solve about this. How long does the training effect last? I mean, if you spend 10 days or a couple weeks acclimating and then you lose it in a day, that's a big problem. Or the other big question they need to answer is how much of this is needed to mitigate a significant fraction of bone loss and cardiovascular loss. These are unknowns, and hopefully there's no deal breakers there. Like if you lose the training effect too fast, or if you need to spend 7 hours a day in this centrifuge, then that could be a deal breaker too. So hopefully, cross your fingers, and hopefully it's much less than that.
Aren't there nausea mitigators visual nausea mitigators that they can use as well?
Because
when it comes down to this type of nausea, it's all about your inner ear mismatching.
Very quickly, so vertigo, like motion sickness type vertigo, is very hard to treat medically. We have meclizine, and you could use benzodiazepines, and they may take the edge off, but they don't really make it go away. So the medication, there are treatments for it, but they're not terribly effective. The most effective treatment for chronic vertigo is what we call vestibular therapy, mm-hmm. which is this.
Is acclimation.
Is some form of, it's acclimation. Right.
Have you seen and I don't even know if these work, but have you seen these weird glasses that have liquid in them?
No.
They're like, you wear them here and here, and they have liquid underneath.
Yeah. Sounds annoying.
It is annoying, but I mean, probably so is going to space. And the movement of the liquid goes along with the movement of your inner ear, and it's supposed to be some sort of like visual mitigation.
Sounds gimmicky. I mean, I'd have to look at some.
It's interesting
data.
That sometimes there are these solutions that, right. if we take a minute and step back, could be simple solutions to these really complex problems.
Are this could really be, though, like that far away from a ship that has a habitat that has a spinning centrifuge in it for, you know, like
it's a big
just
one.
So big.
It's a huge engineering problem, Jay. And also, I mean,
it's a wheel.
How about for like on the moon base Alpha or in a space station, and you could have just these tables. Just have a bunch of these tables and you're good. You don't need to have this huge engineering problem to solve, to create a rotating structure.
All right. Our friend George Robb will be joining us for something that we're calling the SGU taste test.
Oh, gosh.
This is thank you.
All right. Hi, everybody.
Hi,
everybody. Are you ready?
Yes.
No. So Steve and I were having a conversation yesterday sort of about certain things, and there's always been this idea of, like, can people tell the difference between certain very basic kind of tastes? And many professionals say that people can't tell the difference between white wine and red wine, despite the fact that it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, assuming that you can. So I quickly walked up and down the block and tried to find some basic things that our rogues could try to tell the difference between. Very, very, very basic things. We're going to have these cups. We're going to have a nice general taste test of a number of different things. We're gonna start probably first off with the standard, which will be the regular Coke versus the Coke Zero or the Diet Coke sort of replacement. We're going to try that.
No Royal Crown?
We'll do that. We've got these wonderful, delicious Oreo cookies, yes. And they're going to go up against what's called the Back to Nature Classic Cream Cookies, which these
nature.
Were 88 cents for a packet, and this was, I think, like $6 for the same thing. So there was that Whole Foods just down the street, which is all woo product, which is wonderful. We're gonna do tap water and bottled water, of course, which is a fun one. We're gonna have our classic nacho cheese Doritos, which is also about 89 cents a bag, versus the late July nacho chipotle tortilla chip made with organic yellow corn, non-GMO. We're gonna have to see if you can tell the difference between those two.
There goes my diet.
If we're into it, we've also got Bud Light and Triple Allagash Belgian style golden ale. This was $2 and this was $7. So we'll have whoever wants to do the beer. I'm not sure who wants to do. And finally, just for real fun, we've got skim milk and whole milk. Again, I don't know who's intolerant of lactose or whatever. I'm going to set this stuff up back here, and the idea is going to be that I will hand you a thing from behind. You won't look. The audience will know what you're eating. You will not know what you're eating. And to somewhat mitigate the 50-50 chance thing, we're going to give you three samples.
Okay.
Interesting.
Especially
off
the floor. Three samples.
George.
Yeah.
While we're whatever blindfolded or what's happening...
Yeah.
You're not going to slip anything in it, right?
No. We're going to be totally... Yeah,
I was thinking
gonna...
that, Jay, I was thinking the same thing. I'm thinking he's going to put ghost peppers in some in the soda and freak us out.
So while George is setting that up, I think most of you were at the extravaganza last night. I want to thank George for... extravaganza is easy on the SGU and incredibly hard on George because we have to be subjugated to all the things that George throws at us. The only thing that we talk to George about are the bits. But George has to write the content of the bit. So, George, I didn't thank you last night.
Oh, no. It's my
I'm
pleasure.
Going to. Just stand there and smile. George, every time we watch you from the back run that show, we're all in awe of you. You are amazing to perform
with.
We
thank
really
you.
Thank you for
it.
Thank you, George.
That's fine. Thank you. That's nice. I have to say, what's great is that they completely trust me, which is...
Yes, we do.
Very, and I came up with a couple of new games, and it's like, I got a new idea. And then 90 seconds before we go on, I say, this is how it's going to work. And they just go, okay. And so you make it very easy to work with
you guys.
What
was that word last night? Fantabular. What was that?
Cremular.
Cremular.
Cremular. Cremulations upon the heads of you. Okay. Who wants to try, let's say, diet soda and regular soda? Jay's going. Jay and Steve. All right.
Wait, diet and regular?
All right, let's, Steve, let's predict our success.
I think I'll be 100% successful.
I think I'll be 100% successful.
Yeah, sugar and not sugar, I think I can tell the difference between
What do they use in Coke Zero? Splenda?
It's caffeine, Splenda. Though. Is that okay?
If it's a small amount of
okay.
Wine, yeah.
Is it Splenda?
Yeah.
Okay.
Splenda, yeah.
You said that with an English accent.
Splenda.
Is it Splenda?
Splenda.
Is it Splenda?
Hello, Harry Potter.
Kara, you know how yesterday we were talking about...
So guys, so don't turn around.
Yes. Okay,
if you can avoid turning around.
So today, somebody from Johannesburg came up to me and said, when are you guys coming to, South Africa? I said, whenever you invite
I'll
us.
I'll be there next month, but we should all go. I'd love to do a show in South Africa.
I saw your tattoo.
It's on my new Africa tattoo.
I left my heart in Africa.
I left my heart in Africa.
Yeah.
Okay, Jay, here's number one.
Should I close my eyes?
No, you can just...
Okay. Because they look
right
the same.
There.
It's supposed to be a taste test, not a smell test.
So should you guess now, or should you wait until it tastes the other ones? What's the best
way? Let me guess now,
but
I think I can tell just by the smell.
Okay.
Smell.
I think this is diet. That's diet, 100%.
100%.
Yep. Okay, that's number one. Here's number two.
You should swirl it around, Jay.
Oh, yeah, that's high test Coke. That's diet Coke. High test diet.
High test.
Okay, and here is number three.
Wait.
What's this?
To mitigate.
It's one or the other.
Just so it's not fitty-fitty.
Oh, okay. There's two in
That's
the
high test.
Okay. Correct. Incorrect. Correct.
Wow.
That's basically...
Okay, I know Jay. He's not a happy camper right now.
We're going to hear about this for hours.
Yep.
So I was highly confident that I could tell the difference, but...
Son of a bitch.
What are you doing?
Okay. Steve is next.
Yep, I'll do it.
Here's number one.
Same thing?
Okay.
Same thing.
So I would guess that one is... I would guess diet on that one.
I mean, kudos to Coke.
Number two.
Yeah.
Like, really? Wow. I always thought, I mean, man.
An hour, folks.
Diet Coke. Coke Zero. So it's not.
It's Diet Coke.
I would say
zero
that's
calorie.
With sugar.
Yeah, yeah. It's
alternate, you know, sugar Coke.
But what's the one, what is in Diet Coke? What's the sweetener? Not Coke Zero. That's aspartame. Yeah. This is the one with
oh,
Splenda.
Yeah. This
Tastes
is the one
better.
That has the Splenda, yeah.
I only drink diet caffeine-free Coke Zero. What is that one, Steve?
I might revise this now and say this one. Well, I honestly, it's been a long time since I've had Coke with sugar. Good. I think that they've really dialed them in. It used to be so syrupy I couldn't stand it.
Right.
They're much more similar than they used to be. This is subtle, but I would have to guess that this one is... I did one and three are diet and two
I'm
is sugar.
I'm confused. Point to, say diet and point to it.
Diet and sugar it would be my guess.
Be
but
one,
I'm less
one,
confident.
Two diets, one sugar.
Okay. I'm shocked.
Okay. One was regular Coke, two was regular Coke, three was zero.
Okay, so totally random, yeah.
Wait, what's
all right.
One, two, three? I had no idea.
One is over there and three
can
is
we do? Can we do skim and regular
sure.
milk?
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
good?
Yeah, this, come on. This should be easy.
Oh, that's Wait, easy.
That's easy.
That's easy. Ask
you guys
the question.
Anyone in the audience remember people used to mix Pepsi and milk? That was a drink, anybody?
That was a thing?
My
Pepsi
mom,
and
my
milk?
Mom, yes, my mom was from Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
and she used to tell me that people would mix milk and Pepsi as a drink.
Oh!
And then I saw them do it on Laverne and Shirley. And I was like, Mom, you're
That's
right!
Gross.
Would that be like an A cream? Like, does that give you the same kind of effect? No?
But in
I'm,
Laverne
I know it's
Shirley,
not what it is, but would that give you the same kind of effect? But
in Laverne and Shirley, they lived in Milwaukee, I thought.
They were.
Yeah.
So...
I don't know. He said it was a Brooklyn. He said it was a Brooklyn.
Was there only milk in Brooklyn?
Sure. Who does this?
Here's number one.
Number one? Okay.
What is she drinking? Milk?
This is milk.
I don't drink milk, by the way. It's like, ugh, who drinks milk? But I'm just going to taste it. It's like a glass of milk. I have no idea. Let's see the next one.
Yeah, you got to go back.
I got to compare.
Really?
Yeah, I got to compare.
Okay, here's two. Right.
Hey, Bob, aren't you kind of weirded out right now?
I'm shocked at this.
If you don't guess milk, I'm gonna really not believe it.
Are you panicking, Bob?
These
whatever.
Taste the same to me. What's the next one?
Here's three.
One, two, three. They're all the exact same.
It's a trick.
This makes me feel better about the fact that I drink skim milk. Because I honestly
it's 1% and whole? Is that what you think?
It is skim and whole.
Oh, skim?
Skim and whole. That's like cream and
skim
water.
You would think. They taste the same. George, I'm going to say...
I want to try everything that you do. Is that
I'm going to say one is whole and the next two are skim.
Okay.
Is that right?
One was whole.
The first one I tried was whole and the next two were skim. But they all taste the same.
Two was whole.
Two was whole.
Three was skim. So one, two.
One and two are the same. Gotcha. The same. Wow. Okay, so yeah, this was definitely whole and this was definitely skim, but this one I couldn't tell the difference.
Bob, you want milk or you want cookies?
It's fascinating. Huh?
You want milk or you want cookies?
Bob, we're doing a show.
Now? I'm curious. Sorry that George interrupted you. Hey, Bob, you want cookies?
Huh? Cookies? You want cookies?
Jay, I'm sorry, but my whole worldview is crumbling here.
You want to do milk? Let's do milk.
Yes, let's do milk.
Let's do milk. All right.
Milk? It's hard. It's surprisingly hard.
I'm shocked.
When Bob is angry, I think he's adorable.
It's hard not to be adorable. Now, I may be immune to rotational acceleration, but
George,
milk, I hate milk.
Can I have a cookie for you?
Oh, Jay, I won't puke, though. I won't puke. Only in cereal.
Wait, why
it's good
milk
in cereal.
Because
I used to
it's
live.
Not
I
that bad.
I used to argue.
It's not that bad. Well, if you've ever had an ice cream soda, you know, and
yeah, it's
kind of
like
that.
It tastes like root beer almost.
Here we go.
Ugh. Skim. Skim's unright. Ugh.
What is it?
Skim, I think.
Okay. Here's two.
How would you know instantly like that?
I don't know. And it's got to be cold, and this isn't cold.
It's not cold, yeah. It's not
warm, though. It's
cold-ish.
Cold-ish.
People drink this.
Yeah.
I would have friends that would come over and get a big glass of milk and down it. And we're like, what are you doing? That's disgusting. I would go to school and I would have a packet of like chocolate milk because they would give you your milk every day and like I couldn't drink it so I had to put the chocolate milk in there. But then I'd have some left and I would trade it for Twinkies, so it was really cool. All
What's
right.
that one?
What do you got,
no,
bud?
I think these are both skin.
Okay.
Wait.
And here's three.
What the hell? This is a trick.
They're all the same, right?
Come on.
Oh, wait.
I don't know.
Is that weird?
This is terrible. Skim, regular.
What's the middle one?
Yeah, what?
Skim. My
skim,
hand's on two.
Two skims.
Skim.
Bob is right. Skim,
Bob
skim,
right.
Regular.
Bob. Hey,
Bob.
How are you? Sure?
All right, Evan, can you use some nacho chips? Is that cool?
I ate too many donuts today.
Yeah, you want to do that? That's fine.
Okay with that?
Sure.
Bob, do you still remember which one? Don't tell me. Give me one of each.
God.
Do you remember?
So part of the point of this is how much.
Give me that first one.
How much your other
you know
senses
is, right?
are necessary, right? So we expectations.
Yes.
All right. So we have the cheap
that's
Doritos.
Good.
And we have the super expensive.
Right.
That's whole. The aftertaste.
But it was much more subtle than I anticipated.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at it in the bottle, one looks like...
George, am I allowed to cleanse my palate between each one?
Of course, okay. Of course.
All right.
Okay,
this is the
Evan,
first
what
one?
Are you doing?
Okay. Well, it was a chip.
What do you think?
I don't know yet.
I don't know, sir.
I don't know.
All right.
May I have some more?
Here's two.
You could also say which one you prefer.
Y'all hearing that?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, those were different. That is subtle.
So they tasted like the same thing?
Yeah, so far.
Okay.
They could have been the same.
No
Maybe
three.
Not, though. I'll close my eyes here. Dorito, Brand X Dorito.
Correct.
Whoa.
Good job.
I'm 100% confident that there is no knockoff smart food.
Oh, the popcorn you
smart
like?
Smart food is just like...
Yeah, there's tons of white cheddar popcorn
no,
out
that,
there.
But it doesn't taste... Like, whatever they do...
You say that now.
Yeah, I'm telling you. Evan, what did you like better? The non-GMO whole food?
You know what?
Chips,
I actually like the Brand X one better because I'm not a big fan of Dorito. It's not my go-to for a snack ever.
That's a horrible thing to say.
The second one tasted more like corn. Brand X tasted more like corn.
basically.
Nobody expects a corn taste in a Dorito.
It's right.
A Dorito taste.
Okay, Jay, you got to close your eyes for this one, Jay.
Yeah.
So here's
what are we
cookie,
doing now?
Cookie okay. number one. This is Oreo versus the super nutritious return to nature Oreo.
And you can't look at it.
Yeah,
don't look at it. Feel it with your fingers.
That was delicious.
Yeah, don't read the.
There's two.
Yeah, braille. The braille of the cookie.
Non-Oreo, Oreo, non-Oreo.
Wait, how are you handling
that? Wait, which one's which?
Non-Oreo, Oreo, non-Oreo.
You got the last one is right. So the first one was an Oreo, Oreo, non. You had that
wow,
right.
Wow, these are better.
Those are better.
The $6 ones are better.
The nature's breed, whatever, is better. It's better. Huh. I really want someone to try this beer.
You
who's up for trying some beer?
So close that you wouldn't believe it.
Okay.
Yeah. Who's good for trying some beer?
I got none.
I don't drink.
You got any rum?
Bob, do you drink?
Beer? No.
Just anyone Jay? Drink? We don't really drink.
We don't drink.
No, all right, so just Jay.
Jay will
so
do
just
it. Jay.
You know what? Let's do this in the meantime. We're going to do
if you got some meth, though.
Give it to Jay. He'll try anything.
Leanne. Oh, Leanne. Yeah, Leanne.
All right, George.
So
George,
cool.
Can what Leanne and I get the same configuration as we go?
Sure.
So we can kind of do it head-to-head?
I have to point out that with this sample size, we really can't make any scientific conclusions, including the fact that Evan could tell the difference between Dorito and the expensive one. It's possible that if you averaged out all the results, it's probably random chance.
Random, yeah, I would think so.
There we go.
Okay. It's a mind-bending experience because you just think you know what you know.
Yeah. That milk blows my mind.
Okay.
Yeah, I always thought of
the things
milk
we do
like
to justify
really
dating.
Yeah.
Skim milk is watery.
Like water.
Yeah.
So where does the original? Okay. So let's science this.
Yeah.
Because this is like I can like one of these like things my whole life, but like my whole life I drink whole milk and I'm like it's so thick, it's so like I you know because I got used to skim at some point in my life for health reasons like I just didn't want to be eating all that fat for no reason.
Yeah, but skim milk has more sugar.
Yeah.
It does.
Mm.
But I'm telling you, like, at some point, my subconscious mind and everybody else has decided that whole milk has certain properties and skim has certain properties, but it's not that clear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more, it's much more subtle than you would think. Yeah.
Well, who put that information into my head?
Here's number one.
Big Pharma, yeah.
Cheers.
Big Dairy.
All right, this is number one.
Okay. Number one, ready? Yeah, don't say it yet. Let's experience it first so we don't pollute each other's opinion.
Okay.
No pollution.
All right, so what are my choices?
You've got Bud Light or a Super Duper Pops thingy, whatever.
Okay.
Right. Oh, okay.
Fancy expensive beer versus Bud Light.
I have my guess. You have your guess?
I do.
You made it I think it's Bud Light.
I think it's Bud Light as well.
Okay.
Here's two.
I'm trying really not to look at the color.
Can I finish this?
Oh, yeah.
You want, man. Your show. You do it.
This is the hop shit right here. I think I have a super taster thing with hops because.
Yeah, you polluted her.
You polluted her.
Yeah, why are you doing
no,
that?
No, my nose polluted.
See, I can't even follow my own rules. I'm sorry.
Did you taste already?
I didn't say anything.
Okay.
That good, huh?
It was so good for you. No, I. This is.
Is it hard?
Hops, yes.
Okay.
You think that's a hops one?
Yes.
Here's three.
Oh, there's more?
One more.
This is just to eliminate the 50-50. So
this is one of the two.
Yeah, that's it's this right. One is easy. Because
oh,
the
it's
hops
either
in
Bud
here.
Light or the expensive one.
This is this one, so and I thought these were Bud Light.
One and three are Bud Light?
Jay, what do you say?
Yeah, these
one and three.
One and three, yes.
One and three are Bud Light? Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well that brand is not like a ripoff. Of Bud Light. Yeah. It's not a Bud Light ripoff.
Like it tasted very good.
Yeah, I can't go prefer? With that IPA bitter.
All right, give it up for George Robb. Thank you, George.
Thank you.
Yay, George.
Thanks, awesome. Everybody.
Thank you.
We still need to do our super coffee versus cheap coffee and like
yes.
Tea from a tea bag versus like really brewed loose tea.
Mm-hmm. I want to do the coffee one because Jay is such a coffee.
We'll do that at some point. We'll do it at some point. But it does show you.
See, you know, Jay's not going to be over this for a long time.
How much expectation plays a role. All right. So, Kara, this is just a normal MRI of a brain that we're looking at here, right?
Oh, is it?
No.
No. Okay. I didn't know if you had like a comparison or not.
That's beautiful.
There you go.
That's
no, that's beautiful. Not. Okay, so.
Here's the comparison.
There you go. That's good.
What's the difference?
So the difference is this is the highest resolution MRI ever produced.
Really?
Yeah, and so it's.
Is it 4K?
It was presented. It's at 100 microns. That's the resolution. So this was presented in the bioarchive. So it's not peer reviewed yet. This is the preprint. A group of researchers from multiple universities got together and they decided to scan a brain of a woman for 100 hours straight in a 7 Tesla MRI. Now, to be fair, the woman was dead and the brain was not in her body, which made it a little bit easier, and that's why they were able to do this really high-res scan. They actually had to prepare. So it was fixed in formalin for 35 days, and then they had to prepare this really cool case around it that kept it perfectly still and also drew out all the little air bubbles, because apparently little bubbles, you know, oxygen bubbles, are going to make the scan blurry. So they developed a special case to make the brain, and they put a special kind of formalin. It had been in regular formalin for 35 days. Then they moved it over to a special kind of formalin, put it in the scanner, and scanned it for 100 hours. Not 100 hours straight. It was groupings of 25 hours at a time in a 7 Tesla MRI, which is kind of the newest type of MRI, but more and more hospitals are starting to acquire them. So it's not like you can't be scanned in a 7 Tesla, but not every hospital has it.
Yeah, 3 is kind of the standard. Like 1 was like an old MRI. 3 is like, that's a high Tesla MRI. 7 is super.
7 is, yeah, super duper. And this is a woman who died of cancer, but was known to not have, or was thought, still thought to not have any neurological deficits. So this was a kind of neurotypical brain. And these researchers got this. There are videos that you can see of like sagittal slices all the way through. It's pretty weird to watch though, because usually when you look at MRIs of brains, you can see like eyeballs and you know, a spine, but this is just a brain because it's just sitting in there all by itself. But the really cool thing about, I mean, it's really cool because it's never been done before and it's gorgeous and you can see such detail, is that when it really comes down to it, this new, I guess, map, if you want to call it that.
It's an anatomical. It's not a connection map.
Mm-mm.
It's just an anatomical.
Purely anatomical. Yeah. We could call it a, what are they called? They're atlas.
Yeah.
This new atlas is the highest res atlas we have. And we could potentially start looking into neurological changes, differences, standards that might be correlated with things that we would never really be able to see before. You know, oftentimes we're going to be able to see stroke, we're going to be able to see tumors, we're going to be able to see enlarged ventricles, we're going to be able to see a lot of things going on, but maybe not the types of differences in the hippocampus or in the amygdala that might be present in somebody with a psychiatric disorder, for example. And so there's a lot of potential clinical but also basic science that can be used from this brain map. And also now that they've done it and they know how to do it, they could do it again. And they could do it with the brain of somebody who died of Alzheimer's, or the brain of somebody who died of CTE, or who had CTE before they passed away. So it's a fascinating new development.
But not on a living person.
But
it's
no.
It's always post-mortem.
It has to be post-mortem.
Right.
100 hours in a scanner.
But it's not just that.
And you have to be perfectly still.
You have to be perfectly still. It's incapable, even if you anesthetize someone.
Yeah, because your blood is still moving.
And remember,
your brain.
Jay, your brain is pulsating. Mm-hmm.
What about, in all seriousness, what about coma patients?
So even the
couldn't
pulsating
they put a
of the
you
brain
can't put a coma
would
patient.
Blur out this picture.
The blood.
Keep coming
okay.
Out?
And then also just the breathing, you know, just breathing.
Yeah.
And so, and if you're not unconscious, then you can't stay perfectly still. So
what if you studied somebody in artificial gravity? Would that help?
No. No.
What so 100 microns. Think about how small that is. 100 microns.
That's how small
that's the resolution.
That's the resolution.
Yeah. Why is her brain lopsided?
Everyone's brain's lopsided. But also, it depends on how...
Since when?
Jake, since your brain started pulsing.
Yeah,
so that's
if it's not standing up perfectly.
If the cut is not exactly parallel, you know what I mean? So it's anatomically, you can't get like a perfectly...
And remember, they
cut.
Built a case, like a ready-made case. They didn't fabricate. They built it themselves.
Right.
And
in other words,
if
the brain is lopsided in this scanner and you're not doing an exact slice, it'll look that way.
Okay. So what about the benefit of 7 Tesla MRIs for living people?
Okay, fine. It gives you higher resolution, but
not this resolution.
It's not just the power of the magnet; it's the speed of the whole system. Because the faster you could do it, the less the blur.
Right.
Right? So this took 100 hours. It's not impossible that we could do this level of detail on a living person. We would just have to get to the point where we could do this level of scanning in 30 minutes, no, right, or 20 minutes.
Wow.
So that just needs computers that are, whatever, 50 times, 100 times more powerful than what
than
we
what?
Have.
Yeah, and the crazy thing about this is that the researchers couldn't, like, all of the combined computational power that they had in the lab, they didn't have enough RAM. Like, and they didn't have enough storage, so they had to, like, do weird stuff where they would stream portions of the data, and they would put portions of the data in the cloud in order to continue to scan. And that's also why they had to break it up into different sessions.
Well, what kind of computers were they using? Were they using supercomputers? What were they?
I have here, it wasn't that far down in the study. Oh, at autopsy, her fresh brain weighed 1,210 grams.
It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, in case you were interested. But here, there's the prep. They talk all about how they prepped it. They talk about the coil. And then they talk about, data acquisition and all the different scans. And where is it? Oh, here we go. The size of the case-based data exceeded the storage capacity of the RAID provided by the scanner image reconstruction computer. So they use the standard computer. The image reconstruction also required more RAM than what was available. So we implemented software on the scanner to stream the data directly to a server in order to continue to scan.
So it was
It was the computer that's meant to be used with the scanner.
So we've got computers now that could greatly help.
Oh, sure.
This.
It wouldn't be impossible.
It's not like they're waiting for...
You'd have to marry the MRI scanner with a supercomputer.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, do this.
Sure, but there was no reason to do that before.
Do it now.
Like, these are the first people to ever think to scan at this resolution.
Well, it's good to know that we have the technology now to make that leap, and we don't have to wait 20 years for that to happen.
Kara, are we going to have, like, a... explosion of intelligence about this because of the detail of the scan?
I do think that, think of this as a new atlas, like a new, you can see multiple slices, you can see different structures within the brain. Probably many papers will come out of this, I think.
Okay.
You know, a lot of graduate students will use this data to be able to see things that maybe they didn't see before. But if we can then scan multiple brains, then you could compare.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, Evan.
Cool.
Hmm? We're running out of time, but you're going to quickly tell us about gorillas.
Yeah, a new study from the University of Cambridge. Gorillas found to live in complex societies, suggesting deep roots of human social evolution. So gorillas are just absolutely fascinating animals.
Yeah.
I mean, they so are. I mean, you know, first of all, they got these 2-inch fangs, you know, which is, you know, I think is just the coolest thing, especially for vegetarians of all things.
That's
they eat some insects.
They're a threat display.
Yeah, I would think so. That would fend off anyone who's trying to attack the gorillas. They're docile, you know. They're naturally docile. I mean, if you go up to them and you start to, you know, attack them, they will defend themselves.
Yeah.
But they're otherwise docile. They use tools. Male gorillas up to 400 pounds, females up to 200 pounds. So these are just fascinating. And there's so much more information about gorillas. But in any case, but what we can add to the list of gorilla features is that they are collaborative. And that's what this study was looking at. So they took a look at research, used over 6 years of data from 2 research sites in the Republic of Congo. And they documented the social exchanges of hundreds of Western lowland gorillas. And they found out from those observations that those social interactions are much more complex than they thought. Essentially, what it comes down to is that they have these first social tier of tight-knit groups, which consists of about 13 individuals. But this is like akin to having your extended family with you, your aunts, your cousins, your uncles, and these sorts of things. But beyond that, the researchers observed that a further social tier made up of about 40 gorillas, they spend their time together without necessarily being biologically related to each other. So why are they basically doing this? What is the main driving factor in why they're behaving this way? Well, for food collection.
Oh, it wasn't because they're just friends?
No, yeah, right. They just didn't meet on social media or change their Instagram pictures or anything like that. No, they have a collective memory for tracking down some hard-to-find foodstuffs. So the more you have in the group, they'll use their resources essentially so that they can feed themselves. And it's really fascinating. Here's the real crux of it, though. And, you know, why is this important? Because... And how does it relate to people, essentially? Some scientific theories had posited that the evolution of the sophisticated social brain, you know, like humans have, that we thought was unique to hominids, the discovery of this has evolved apparently earlier from our common ancestor. We thought this only went back 100 to 200,000 years of evolution. But actually, these social hierarchies may have emerged somewhere closer to 8 to 10 million years ago.
I have to say, though, Evan, I think that they're overcalling that, because I've been reading about how social primates related to us are for decades. I don't think that that was the view before this study.
You mean 100 to 200,000 years?
No, I'm saying the idea that gorillas and chimpanzees and our primate relatives, I mean, there's an entire, I read a whole book about this,
Isn't this what Diane Fossey was doing decades ago?
No, I think this is maybe adding to that. Yeah. There are a higher complexity to the social hierarchy and the cooperation. But just the idea that they're social is not new.
Social perhaps is not new, but the observations are just making it firm.
Takes it to
another level. They're reaffirming, essentially.
Yeah, take it to another level. But let's not pretend like we thought the humans were the only social primate. That's bullshit.
Well, the question is, did we independently evolve brains to be social along these multiple lines of apes, or did all of our common ancestors live in social societies prior to those?
Well, the further back you go down the tree, that means that the more and more that came after had those traits. But most importantly about this study, though, is that this is clearly pointing to the origin of the statement, getting the monkey off of my back. Mm. Look at the two guys in the picture with the two monkeys on their backs.
Yeah, they're not monkeys.
Close enough, though. You get the idea. Like, I guess monkeys... Like that, I thought that saying was just like made up. But
no, of
apparently,
course monkeys carry their babies on their back.
I know, but I never knew that the saying came from like monkeys on their backs of the parents.
That was my takeaway too, Jay.
That's the importance. We recently discovered a 1 kilometer asteroid very close to the Earth. The reason why we just discovered it is because it was inside the orbit of Earth. It's hard to detect them because you only have 20 minutes before and after sunset to observe them because they're closer to the sun than we are.
One kilometer.
Yeah.
Ouch.
That's big enough to do real damage.
That's it. That was
the whole story. Because we have just enough time for science or fiction.
Yay.
A quick science or fiction.
Just enough. Very, very quick.
It's time for science or fiction.
All right, we have 3 science news items here. 2 are real, 1 is fake. And we're going to see if we could fool my panel of skeptics into telling me which one is the fake, and the audience gets to play along. All right, here we go. Item number 1. Scientists recently published a thorough description of Aurora ceratops, a close relative of Triceratops that walked on 2 legs. Item number 2. Scientists discover that fruit flies experience chronic pain, which lasts after an injury has healed. That's basically the definition of chronic pain. And item number 3, a new study finds that REM, rapid eye movement sleep, associated with dreaming, can magnify limbic activity associated with fear and anxiety. Okay, we're going to poll the audience first. Mm-hmm. We're going to do the single clap method. So if you think that the item about the Aurora ceratops is the fiction, clap. Well done. We didn't even have to practice.
Yeah.
Item 2, if you think that the one about flies feeling chronic pain is the fiction, clap. And number 3, if you think the one about sleep magnifying limbic activity associated with fear and anxiety, if you think that's the fiction, clap. All right, so I would say 2, 1, 3
is where the audience is
starting. So let's start on the right side with Evan. And Evan, just give me your quick thoughts on what you think about these items.
Well, when I think about a dinosaur on 2 legs, I remember that scene from Jurassic Park when the brontosaurus, the allosaurus, got up on 2 legs, to feed at the very high branches of the tree. I thought that was a pretty incredible thing. But this is talking about walking on 2 legs. So that's...
It was bipedal. It was not just rearing up. It was bipedal.
Right. Okay. So that's amazing. The next one with the fruit flies, how much fruit fly... work are scientists doing? A lot. So I'm not surprised that they've probably discovered that this is the case. There's just so much fruit fly experiments going on. The third one about REM sleep associated with dreaming can magnify limbic activity associated with fear and anxiety. Jesus, this is one I don't have any real kind of feeling on. Just for that reason alone, I'll say that one's the fiction due to my own ignorance.
Okay, Jay?
Right out of the gate, I'm going to say the one about the REM sleep with the anxiety. That one is science because I am
you know, I have anxiety and fear from, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, like if I'm dreaming about something awful happening or whatever. I don't know. I mean, it's like I have a little anecdote. It's my own really information. Okay, so the second one, I'll just go in reverse order, about the chronic pain. I hear what you're saying, Evan. I agree with you that they do study the hell out of fruit flies. But determining if they have chronic pain after an injury, wow. That's really specific. And I know that they hook up electrodes and all this stuff and everything, but how would they know? They'd have to read the nerve signals to the brain. Because it's also weird to think that the insects experience quote-unquote pain like we do. I don't know if if you classify it as pain or not. So I got a little problem with that one. The first one here, the thorough description. So let me cut right to it. A triceratops, a close relative of a triceratops. So picture a triceratops. A close relative to me means, you know, okay, it looks kind of like a triceratops on two legs. It doesn't work in my brain. It just doesn't make any sense. Because you got that weird, he'd be like, help me, you know, like that. What a miserable existence.
Yeah, which one was the diet soda, Jay?
I know.
Right.
That was not cool. So because of what Evan said, thank you, that they studied the hell out of fruit flies, because I wouldn't have reminded myself of that, I would think, okay, some guy in a lab hooked up an electrode to the butt of a fruit fly and said, you're in chronic pain. I'm going to say that the first one is the fiction about the triceratops. Auroraceratops?
Auroraceratops, yeah.
Cool name.
All right.
Okay. Sarah? So, ceratops, horned head, aurora, I don't know, moves from a region. They are quadrupeds. Ceratopsians are all quadrupeds. So it could be a relative, though, and then it's not a ceratopsian, but it's called ceratops. When you say it walked on two legs, is it a biped or a facultative biped?
You said biped.
Biped.
Not a facultative
not
biped.
Not a facultative biped.
At all.
Facultative biped.
Okay.
It's a cool word.
That's really different.
Can you please
I can imagine
tell me
a facultative. It's the ones that walk on two legs sometimes and walk on four legs other times. So they have like smaller front limbs and larger hind limbs.
I know people like
that. They do both. Yeah, that's interesting. But a close relative, how close? I mean,
that's the question.
It's a ceratopsian,
exactly.
Though. They gave
it's
it a ceratopsian name.
It's a ceratopsian. It's in that same group.
Ceratopsians walk on four legs.
Part
that's
of the ceratopsian
like of
family.
Okay, yeah. So fruit flies experience chronic pain. Again, same thing. What do you consider pain? How do we know if they... Usually pain is like a response. So they, you know, will pull away from something. That's how we measure pain in the lab. Even after the injury is healed, okay. I mean, that's interesting. So it's like limping, even if we've healed its leg, maybe. And then REM sleep. This one's confusing to me. REM sleep associated with dreaming can magnify limbic activity. What does that even mean? How do you magnify brain activity? What does that mean?
Yeah, so in other words, like the limbic activity associated with fear and anxiety, right? So if we look at the activity in the brain.
General activity associated with fear and anxiety.
Yeah, in other words,
system.
You can correlate, like, you know, the limbic system causes anxiety.
Absolutely.
So that's more active.
So it's worse.
It's worse after REM sleep, yeah.
Okay, worse after REM. So basically you're afraid of flying or something, you dream, and then you're like more afraid of flying, or like you see a bigger peak in your measurement. Yep. These could all be real and they could all be fiction. The Triceratops one really bothers me, which is why it's probably science. Because he always does that to us. So Jay
said
that's
what he wants you to think right now.
Do you agree with
that? Yeah, Jay said that's the fiction. Evan said the REM sleep.
I said REM sleep is the fiction.
I'm going to go with the fruit fly so we don't sweep Steve.
There you go.
All right, Bob. No help from the Earth 3 colleagues.
Wow. What? What is that supposed to mean?
Because you're all spread out.
Yeah, we each chose a different one.
I thought we all said very good logical arguments.
If you could look at it that way.
Some of you did.
Some more than others.
Some of you did. The REM sleep, I'll start with three. The REM sleep kind of makes sense to me because I know that when you're dreaming, what you experience is so realistic because your body is actually experiencing in many ways what you're dreaming. That's why your body paralyzes itself. So you don't like walk out the window because you're dreaming about walking. So so that kind of makes sense that it could have an effect on your limbic system if you have an especially anxiety-inducing dream. So I can kind of see that.
You got 4 minutes, Bob.
4 minutes. Oh, boy.
So you don't have 4 minutes. We all have 4 minutes.
Okay. Okay, the chronic pain. Yeah, I could see some diagnostic tool that could make them lead them to believe that there is pain somehow being experienced after an injury. The first one, I can't get past this. Auroraceratops, as a biped, how could it be a close relative and be a biped compared to the quadruped triceratops? So that one, to me, seems to be the fiction, so I'll just go with my gut and say that's fiction.
All right, let's see if you influence the audience very, very quickly. If you think the Auroraceratops is the fiction, clap.
If you think that the fruit fly is the fiction, clap. If you think that the REM sleep is the fiction, clap.
All right.
One and two
Whoa.
Seem dead in
time.
And it was at the beginning, too, I think.
All right, so I guess we'll start with the third one then, since that's where the consensus is. So a new study finds that REM sleep associated with dreaming can magnify limbic activity associated with fear and anxiety. Evan, you think this one is the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the rogues thinks this one is science. Almost the entire audience thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Oh, wow.
Good job, Evan.
Hey, I picked that one as the fiction.
Did it again.
You picked the Triceratops.
You went with the Triceratops, the Auroraceratops. Don't worry about it.
Wait. Which one did you just say?
The REM is the fiction. You said the other. So
REM is fiction.
I was in my own world for a minute. I'm like, I'm going to win.
So
holy crap.
The study found the opposite.
Oh, interesting.
So sleep helps the brain organize its information, and it helps you process information, and it also helps you deal with trauma, with fear, and anxiety.
But what about when you wake up in the middle of the night, like, wah?
So they weren't looking at people who were having a nightmare or like having, you know, the fear response in sleep. What they found was people were anxious when they went to sleep with increased limbic activity. If they had a good night's sleep, the limbic system calmed down, especially during the REM sleep. Their limbic activity reduced.
Oh, great.
And the people who had interrupted sleep and poor quality sleep and didn't really have a good, you know, sleep architecture, as we call it, didn't have good REM sleep, they had sustained anxiety. So lack of sleep is actually bad for your anxiety.
That makes sense. Yeah. Actually, that makes sense.
But I knew you could kind of make sense of this both ways, which is why I liked it as the fiction.
Do you guys read Strange Planet, the comic? No, nobody? Strange Planet? A couple of you. Yeah, there's a classic one where the alien tells his son, like, dream of pleasant nonsense.
Pleasant nonsense. So we'll go back to number two. Scientists discover that fruit flies experience chronic pain, which lasts, and just so you know what that means, which lasts after an injury has healed. That one is science. Yes, we do a lot of fruit fly research. This is cool. So it's, you know, whether or not insects experience pain is, you know, an interesting, a somewhat open question. Of course, we don't know what it feels like to be a fruit fly, right? So we don't know what they're actually experiencing. But we do operationally know what pain is. It's a negative experience that, you know, changes an animal's behavior so that they withdraw from that stimulus.
Yeah.
So yes, fruit flies do withdraw from pain. And what this was the first study to show is that the hypersensitivity that results from pain persisted chronically after the injury completely healed. So it's no longer a response of the injury itself. Now, in humans, we call that neuropathic pain.
Or it could be a learned response to the stimulus.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. It could remember that stimulus was painful.
But that's not exactly what they weren't just going on behavior.
I think what they found was that some of the fruit flies learned to fake a limp to get attention.
So, but what they were actually doing was looking at the activity in the neurons in the fruit fly.
Oh, gotcha.
And so what they found was that the fruit fly nerves, if you will, actually changed. They became hypersensitive biochemically, and they stayed that way even after the injury was healed.
Does that happen in humans?
So yes, we call that neuropathic pain. It's when you get the pain is arising from changes in the way the nervous system behaves, not detecting soft tissue injury.
Can you get rid of that?
It's very hard.
I mean, an extreme example is that we have pain even when we lose limbs sometimes.
Yeah, you have phantom limb pain.
Phantom, sure.
So there are treatments for neuropathic pain, but it's hard to treat and it's complicated. But what the good thing is about this is if that mechanism, and they think that it is, if that mechanism of the fruit fly neurons experiencing neuropathic pain is similar enough to human neurons, at least in some cases. And in this particular case, it was what we call central sensitization, which means that, so normally the central nervous system inhibits the pain signals as they come in.
Mm-hmm.
There's an inhibitory tone, right? So it sort of puts the brakes on the pain, as they say. But that inhibitory control goes away, and that's what happened with the fruit flies, but the inhibitory control didn't come back. And that is one type of neuropathic pain in humans, loss of the central inhibition.
How do you get that back?
We don't know how to make it come back. We just give drugs to mimic to mimic the inhibition.
Steve, negative 1 minute.
Yeah, we can go. I was told we can go a little over.
Okay.
I told him about it.
Yeah, I was told. Somebody told me I could do this.
Hans says we can go over. We're going over.
All right.
So let's anyway, go over.
So this means that this could be a good model, animal model of human neuropathic pain. So we might be able to study human neuropathic pain in fruit flies. That's awesome.
But Steve, right. Do we really know? I mean, this is why I always question stuff like this. Like, it seems like we're saying like it's experiencing pain. Like, are we sure that it's pain?
No. Fruit fly pain. It's whatever is pain to a fruit fly.
Are we sure that it's fruit fly pain?
Yeah.
We know it's a change in the fruit fly's behavior and neurophysiology. And
their neurological right. activity, I mean, in a way that acts for them like pain does for us. Pain is a negative experience.
Good enough.
Injury. Okay.
So right now, there could be millions of fruit flies suffering.
Right now, there are millions of fruit flies suffering.
We can't. This is bullshit. I can't sit for this.
Right.
We're here in New York City eating and drinking Oreos and Coke that we don't know what the kind of Coke we're drinking. And fruit flies across the globe in laboratories are suffering.
This is what happens
here.
When you tell them we can go over.
Yeah,
you
just got to keep it to yourself.
Hans, never tell me to go over again. I'll
Give
talk
us a
about
hard cut next time, Hans.
All right. Scientists recently published a thorough description of Aurora ceratops, a close relative of Triceratops that walked on two legs. I forgot to put the picture in the slides, but I think I have it right here.
You had a picture of the two-legged?
Yeah, where was
it? Steve, opening your browser, very dangerous in public.
I know.
Like
yeah,
this.
Right, no kidding.
making me all sorts of nervous,
man.
Boy.
You're rolling the dice
here. I don't
want to
know. Wait, I know more things than I want to know about you. They don't want to know what I know about you.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry I forgot to get the picture of it.
All right, what does it look like?
18,000 emails?
I know.
Steve? What the hell?
It's really stressing me out.
It looks like...
I've got twice
so,
that.
All right, so there's a... This is actually one of the few dinosaurs that we now know from a complete skeleton, mm-hmm. right? So there's multiple different specimens. We don't have all the bones from one specimen, but if you put all the specimens together, we have all the bones for this dinosaur. Many dinosaurs are known from just a skull. For a while, this dinosaur was known from just a skull. And we said, this is a Triceratops relative. It's definitely in the Ceratops family. It has little proto-horns, a little protophyll, not fully developed. It's earlier on in the tree than Triceratops. But then once we got all the bones, we're like, holy shit, this thing is walking on two legs. And it looks like a T-Rex in terms of its the way it's
but
constructed.
But does it have the head of a Triceratops?
No. It's an herbivore, so it doesn't have that mass. I'm just saying, like, it has the big legs, so it's walking with a horizontal...
So more like a mysore, an iguana.
Yeah, with little legs hanging off the front.
It has arms. They're not teeny, teeny like T-Rex. It has arms. It doesn't have a huge head. That's why it doesn't need small arms. But it has the horizontal spine and the big legs in the back, and it's walking on two rear legs. Cool. It's a bipedal Triceratops. It's amazing. They were completely surprised by that. So they finally published a thorough evaluation with all the specimens and really confirming that that's the case. So
why
did
they call
surprising.
It Aurora Ceratops?
I didn't have time to figure that
that's,
out.
That's a
cool name, though,
dinosaur.
Aurora Ceratops.
Yeah,
I love
cool.
that name. All right. So good job, Evan.
Good job, thank
Evan.
You, thank you. And thank you for
Fooled
the two people
the
in
audience,
the audience.
But
you also got it right.
All right. So we're almost done. Evan,
yep.
Bring us home with a quote.
The fascination of any search after truth lies not in the attainment, which at best is found to be very relative, but in the pursuit, where all the powers of the mind and character are brought into play and are absorbed by the task. One feels oneself in contact with something that is infinite, and one finds joy that is beyond expression in sounding the abyss of science and the secrets of the infinite mind. Florence Bascom, the first woman hired by the U.S. Geological Survey, she was the second American woman to earn a Ph.D. in geology and the second woman elected to the Geological Society of America.
Thank you guys all for joining me for the show.
It was a fun thing.
Thank
you.
Anytime, thank
Steve.
You,
and
Nexus,
George,
and thank all of you guys for joining us. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. Dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.